The content of this podcast should not be considered financial or investment advice. All interviews and discussions are opinions only, and the podcast has been created without taking into consideration the listener's financial objectives, financial situation, or needs. Listeners should obtain independent advice before making any financial decisions. G'day, this is Barry Fitzgerald, Garen Pereira columnist for StockEd. Welcome to another edition of the Explorers podcast. Today we're catching up with White Cliff Minerals. ASX code is WCN, trading at around 1.5 cents for a market cap of 20 million. Now it's a well-known name in this market, and it still has a collection of assets over in WA, notably Lake Johnson, where it's hotter than hot for lithium exploration. And up near Meekatharra, it has the Reedy South project, where it actually has a JORC resource of around 42,000 ounces. But the big news out of this company, with its light market capitalization, is a pivot to the northern Canada with a gold and silver project in Nunavut and a uranium and silver IOCG play called Radium Point in a historic part of Canada for uranium mining, historically anyway. So to bring us up to speed, we have the executive chairman, Rod McElree, with us today. Now, Rod's a geo, originally born in Sydney, spent time at the School of Mines in Perth, but he's London-based now. And I'm just going to give you a feel for his background. I'm talking Medusa in the Philippines, Anvil Mining over there in the Congo, King Rose up in Sumatra, and then a lot of time in Greenland with various companies, and another stint back in Africa. So he either likes it hot and cold. So I guess northern Canada, he's reverting back to the cold parts of the world, looking for the next big one. So with that, I'll introduce Rod. Rod, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Barry. No, it's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
All right, I've more or less given a quick summary of your career there over the last 20 years or so. What is it about Australia you don't like?
look, you know, I'm as nationalistic as the next guy, Barry. But look, to a certain extent, I think a lot of this sort of exploration comes down in many ways down through statistics. You need to be on the leading edge of the exploration wing to sort of find the next generation of big mine. You need to be frontier, located in the jungles of the Philippines, let's say, or in the, you know, the central part of the Congo in Africa. That's where the statistics are in your favor. This is one thing I noticed when I was working full time or going to university at the School of Mines full time as well, is that to a certain extent Australia's been walked over, and odds of you sort of finding anything there are sort of, it's a law of diminishing returns in many respects. Now, there's two aspects really of the Canadian adventure that we're on at the moment. Number one is this part of the world has kind of always been, you know, it's very much frontier for its remoteness, logistical challenges, several other issues, getting the sort of the roads, etc. But if are familiar with those processes. You know, I spent the last 20 years working in the Arctic Circle, and we've dragged out from underneath sort of cover several very large deposits historically, and that's really the model that we're applying to Canada, is that these things have by and large been forgotten about or are yet to be discovered. They're still sticking out of the ground. The second that boat is really Canada's hungry. Whereas Australia is, you know, you can get bogged down for years in red and green tape. And one of the things that I sort of like to point at now recently with the application process and the award process for these two licenses that we went through, you know, from application to receipt of the actual license in both instances for Copper Mine and for Radium Point took less than 2 months. The service providers in that part of the world are also quite keen to sort of get some work on as well. So you can get, you know, drillers, service helicopters, service providers in general for, you know, 66 cents in the dollar, whereas, and you can get them tomorrow. Whereas Australia, paying $1.20 and you got to wait 6 weeks.
So these two pickups are Iridium Point and Copper Mine. Were they, was that vacant open ground, was it?
Yeah, so the way that this sort of all came about, without going into too much detail, myself and several colleagues had worked inside the Arctic Circle, as I mentioned. We sort of worked on some big deposits in Greenland and Finland, etc. We sort of stuck together once we moved on from that. And one of the fellows during the COVID lockdowns in Canada just spent a lot of time in the mines department in the basement, just reading the old paper reports. And it seems to be some sort of function, Barry. The only reason I can attribute to these lost deposits, if you like, is that with that sort of updating of the format, you know, so from a paper report to a microfiche to a punch card to a analog to a digital, not all the information seems to have been transitioned. And I don't know what happened. People lost interest in doing it, and the box of those reports gets pushed to the back of the room, and then all of a sudden it sits there for 50 years. But the amazing thing about this is we walked into Canada, put a license, a big license, especially in Radium Point case, 3,000-odd square kilometres, over what was Canada's largest uranium mine between 1930 and 1960. You know, that's remarkable. And so that just comes back to this concept of statistics in exploration. You've got to put yourself in the right jurisdiction to be able to do that.
Well, the land position here is as crowded as it comes. So you wouldn't be able to pick it up in Australia at all, I would suggest. So, yeah, Radium Point, let's talk about that uranium and silver with the IOCG potential. As you said, historic producer of 13.7 million pounds of uranium, 34 million ounces of silver, and 11.3 million pounds of copper. So a very handy producer back in the day, but it's been left alone for a few decades, has it?
Yeah, so it sort of, the whole process or the uranium side of it collapsed in the early 60s. The reason that the mine got started was really because of its metallurgy in the first instance. It was very high grade. It was vein outcropping at surface. And this particular project supplied, I think it was between 10 and 15% of the material that went into the Manhattan Project. And that was because of its simplicity of extraction and its high U-235 content. That whole nuclear renaissance in America, if you like, that if you sort of know your history in uranium, the world was saturated in uranium in the early 60s. World War II had finished and everyone was sort of building their nuclear reactors and there was uranium everywhere. So the price of uranium went down at sort of, you know, a single digit. Around $7, I remember reading there somewhere. And so they moved on to silver. And this, without sort of boring everyone, your listeners to tears on the geology of this thing, what effectively this is sort of a volcanic arc. So it was a spreading area, lots of volcanic activity, very reactive rocks, and also, more importantly, very deep plumbing here. You've got structures that sort of tap the mantle, these fluids, very metal-rich fluids, sort of transposing all these metals into these reactive rocks. And what you're seeing at surface is the last gasp of the emplacement process where those sort of very volatile, more soluble metals are sort of pushed out of the settlement system within that broader IOCG, which appears to be sort of a little bit deeper, bulk on lower grade, but you get these crackle veins coming off it that have all these high grade materials. You know, these veins of silver there that they were mining, if you add up all those numbers, it's about $2 billion worth of metal that was extracted from these mines during that 40, 50 year period in today's terms. But there are veins there that were, when they were exploiting them, were running 5% silver. So, you know, you've got very high grade uranium, very high grade silver, and a copper occurrences all through this. We have pretty significant data sets, as you could imagine, for something that was in production for, you know, several decades. The grades that we're seeing throughout the broader area and the prospectivity and the outcropping and the gossans and the sort of the anomalies are really quite exciting on this. You know, we anticipate having a pretty big season there this year where announced the copper mine start of the work programs. Lots of birds in the air, let's call them. That will be followed up by ground truthing, sort of on-site verification of some of these results, because in this day and age, you know, we've all got scars from putting out results that, you know, the ASX sort of comes back and says, oh, well, show me your verification of this. So we were very cautious putting out historical results here until such time as we're able to fully verify them ourselves. I think the benefit of that also is it sort of creates that discovery phase effect, which, you know, to a certain extent, this is a historical mine. It's been forgotten about. And the rediscovery of that, I think, is really the value proposition for Radium Point moving forward. You know, we're going to have a couple of fixed wing, a helicopter fixed wing, several teams running around there. I expect some pretty exciting numbers to be coming off that area there.
What's the immediate forward program at Radium Point?
Yeah, I think we'll start with sort of airborne radiometrics, EM, the teams that we'll be sending in there. So hopefully we can sort of get all of this kicked off in the front end of the season. So these are seasonal access, obviously. You can get in there all year round, but just for your consultants, contractors and employee comfort, you don't send them in when it's dark and cold, obviously. But the airborne radiometrics, airborne electromagnetics, the gravity, all that will sort of feature in these two distinct surveys. We are really going to try and drill the Radium Point this year, but obviously we need to orientate ourselves. You've got to keep in mind we only pick these licenses up really in sort of January and February, had them approved. So now that that has been done, we can actually dial in on what we're going to do. But I would expect that we'll have people on site there, you know, June, something like that, early June, to coincide with the end of the aerial surveys. Importantly, Barry, one of the things, there's quite a few visuals on the website if people want to sort of go there, given how significant a producer this deposit was back in the 30s to the 60s. There's a very large airstrip there. Most of the buildings have been removed, remediated. The site has sort of been sort of toned back into a sort of a remediated area. But there is a very large airstrip still there. So that immediately adjacent to the areas that we want to do work program, there's roads out the area. So we can get in and out of there very easily, which is fantastic, right? Because otherwise it just adds an extra layer of complexity if you've got to land on grass. So that's very helpful. And the similar sort of thing up at Coppermine. There's, just to the north of the main project area is a town, 1,500 people. One of the things you learn when you run around these sort of very isolated environments is the closer you are to a population and the logistics center, the better. You know, your life becomes order of magnitude more difficult for every mile you move away from a town.
Okay, interesting one. Now, in Nunavut, the copper mine, the gold-silver project, high-grade copper hits, and when we say high-grade, really seriously rock chips of 30% plus copper with silver, a number of prospects. So give us a bit of a background on the copper mine.
Yeah, well, I mean, this is an interesting situation that's evolving here. From a 40,000-foot view of this sedimentary hosted copper type deposit or project area, you're seeing BHP come into this area. So basically what this is that there's a vast sedimentary basin that straddles all the way from Poland, Germany, goes through Holland, up through Greenland, the top end of Greenland, and over into the northern part of Nunavut and then sort of into Russia. And it's a huge sedimentary basin. It's got zinc, etc. But it's houses what is now becoming recognised as these red bed copper hosted sedimentary deposits. They range anywhere between sort of 0.5% all the way up to 5%, depending on how proximally you are to the actual plumbing or the mineralising fluid structures. What this is, that makes this interesting, is this sedimentary basin, a copper mine, has basically had extensional forces applied to it through rifting, where sort of the northern part in that sort of Arctic Arctic Ocean separation process has created deep fractures. Again, there's a sort of a failed rift system there. Very deep. I mean, this is really the one common denominator with all major projects. You have to go to where the deep plumbing is because that taps those very metal-rich fluids. So what we've got here is this project has a lot of patina as well. It traced back to the sort of early 1700s where early explorers found Inuit locals had sort of pure native copper idols, native copper tools, set off a ground rush in the early 1900s. It was one of Canada's most staked areas because of logistics, the challenge of location and, you know, the climate at the time. These areas were sort of, again, forgotten about until, you know, probably, I think it was a couple of people started talking about getting back in there. In the 70s, they made a big song and dance. It was in the media. And as I said, one of my colleagues sort of found references to this. What we have here in a simple sense is a structure. So you've got a sedimentary horizon. There's two geological models, a sedimentary horizon that is very extensive. And we will be almost certainly drilling copper mine this year. I'm getting more and more confident of that as the days go by. And what we will be doing is testing those red bed sediments for higher grade mineralization. The second string bow, again, similar sort of crackle vein concept from the volcanics that are providing these fluids and pathways, is you're getting, you referenced before, these super high grade areas. I mean, there's parts here that were off the scale. They were so high that they couldn't actually analyze them back in those days because the peak stopped at 40%. So we have a structural corridor along which there are already identified high-grade slithers, if you like, within that structural corridor that are a couple of kilometres long and all the way along sort of indicating sort of plus 30%. And we've got 100 kilometres. So I'm expecting big things out of that, this project. I think, you know, getting in there and doing the drilling is going to really raise some eyebrows coming into what is effectively a very favourable copper market. You know, like BHP is basically, we're talking about that glowing North Arctic basin. BHP has taken out huge swathes of that over the last sort of 18 months, and we sort of got the first mover advantage into this part of the world. More importantly, climate change, believe in it, don't believe in it, whatever. In this part of the world, it's very clear it's happening. And this is what access to this, you know, that permafrost is now retreating significantly. And, you know, your seasonal activity has gone from, you know, 30 years ago has gone from, you know, 8 weeks of comfortable work time to now being sort of 16 to 22 weeks of comfortable work time. That makes a huge difference when you need time.
Now, I mentioned the $20 million market cap earlier, and you've got these two new exciting projects, potentially high impact projects, drilling perhaps by the end of the year. But you can't do this if you don't have the funds. What's the funding situation like?
Yeah, so we're in good shape, actually. We've got $6.5 million Aussie in cash. We just completed a fully underwritten option conversion. These were options that were on issue prior to me joining the company. That raised 4.3. The directors the directors and the associated parties within the organisation have put in the best part of $600,000 as well. We've got liquid assets in other listed entities in Australia from divestment programs that equates to, it's volatile, but about $1.2 million. In various holdings. So all in, we're about $6.5 million Aussie in cash, and we are going to apply all of that to these two projects, and maybe we might announce shortly a program at Lake Johnson and also a small program at Reedy's that will come to them in a sec. But certainly as you said, getting these two high impact projects, getting them back on the table of global assets, because that they have been forgotten about, and therein lies the opportunity for your listeners, Barry. Is no one, the industry has forgotten about these things, that the market has forgotten about these assets. The fact that we've been able to come in and just put a license on them is so value accretive for the company, rather than acquiring them from a third party and issuing a bazillion bits of paper and then, you know, wearing that all the way up. What you see now is what you get in terms of that market cap of is 25 with 6.5 in the tin. So for 19 Aussie, you're getting Coppermine, Radium Point, Reedy South, Lake Johnson, and a couple of divestments coming up in the future. And, you know, I can tell you that we're just now that fundraising is complete and the licenses have been issued and we're about to kick the whole work programs off. The roadshow starts here in England now, and it will evolve into a roadshow in Perth early in April. And the job is really to get these projects back on the peer group.
Tickle along at Lake Johnson and Reedy South.
Yeah, look, I mean, these were projects that were already in the company when I arrived. There was a sort of quite a broad brush strokes of various items. We have divested several of them since I joined. We got some stock in Tim Goyder's MI6. We are about to divest another one, and we will be left with Lake Johnson and Reedy's is the ultimate goal. I think in the short term, we will. Reedy's is actually an interesting project. It's got an existing 40-odd thousand ounce resource of gold. It's open at depth and a long strike. It's quite remarkable that this thing sort of is just a satellite, deposit at surface that's never been followed up at depth and a long strike. I mean, that's one thing we were going to do in the short term is put one to the north, put one to the south, put two underneath it and see where we're at.
See where the go is, yeah.
Lake Johnson is a geochemical sampling, quite close space grid, multi-element. We'll check for lithium. You know, there's a lot going on in that part of the world. You've got Rio, TG Metals and Charger. Yeah, so, you know, this is the extension to that belt. So presumably you're going to get continuity, but let's wait and see.
Alrighty, Rod, you've outlined a fascinating story there. Go north, young man, with looking at securing those two potentially high impact projects, plus edging things along out on the gold and lithium front in WA. So we'll be watching with interest. Good luck with it all.
Yeah, thanks very much for your time, Barry. It's been good to talk to you.
Cheers.